Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Later in the hour today, Chico author and retired dentist Mike Paul will tell us stories he heard from pilots at the Sky Kitchen Cafe, a small airport diner in San Carlos. Fred Setterberg is the recipient of an NEA Fellowship and numerous journalism awards. His essays and reporting have appeared in the Iowa Review, the Southern Review, the New York Times, The Nation, Utney Reader, the Boston Phoenix, and many other journals and magazines. He is author of The Roads Taken, Travels Through America's Literary Landscapes, which is winner of the Association of Writers and Writing Programs Prize in Creative Nonfiction. He has now written an autobiographical novel, Lunch Bucket Paradise, which gives us a look at the post-war dreams of a working-class California suburb. He helps us remember that time of innocence and boom as the narrator observes the world of his parents, the greatest generation. Fred Setterberg, welcome.
Thank you, Nancy. Great to be here.
You know, I looked a long time at the cover of your book, and for one thing, it has a car with a tail fin on it. I mean, that's iconic. But also, on the cover, there's a little boy there smiling out at us.
He's cute, isn't he?
He is.
Yeah. He's not me.
Oh, really?
No. He was the boyfriend as a child of the editor of the book. And that's one of the things that we play with in this book. It's subtitled A True Life Novel, which begs the question, what are you talking about? What is that? And it's what the book evolved to be. I tried to write this book three different times. And I tried writing it as a traditional novel with a rising arc of action that will fall two-thirds of the way through the book and resolve everything in some manner at the end. And I just couldn't get the timing right. And I really had given up on writing the book. I had set it aside and thought, well, you know, there goes 10 years. That's too bad. I wish I would have got it done. I wrote three other books while I was working on this one. But it kept itching at me. I wanted to write this book because I felt that the world that I grew up in, blue-collar America circa 1950s through this end of the 60s, was something I didn't find in literature or in pop culture. It was either sentimentalized or it sort of missed the point. You know, the suburbs I'm writing about are not the suburbs of John Cheever short stories, and they're certainly not the suburbs of Leave It to Beaver. You know, they're a rougher place in all senses of the word, and a place that was really just in the process of becoming. I mean, if we think back to 1950, the book opens with a spotlight in the air, you know, the sort of spotlight that in 1950 told people there was a new supermarket opening or a new used car lot or, in this case, a new subdivision yet to be built. And I wanted to write about that time when we were not yet a suburban nation. I mean, now, for good or ill, we're a country that's dominated by the suburbs. But in 1950, it was still an experiment. And the people I'm writing about are they're working people who had been bloodied by the war and kicked about by the Depression. And now in the post-war boom, they find, against all expectations, they suddenly have the possibility of grabbing the next rung on the ladder up the American dream. They can become homeowners. And there are also folks who know that that ladder is slippery, and they're always looking over their shoulder. And they have a sense that things are going fine now, that's right, but just you wait, because life will hand you surprises. And, you know, when I began this book, of course, I had no idea that we would bumble into the financial crisis of 2008, still with us today, and so many of the dreads and nightmares that are still present for my characters throughout the 50s and 60s, of course, have come to pass over the last 4 years.
Well, when I was looking at this photograph, I kept flipping back to the photograph of you as author back in the back of the book, and I really saw resemblance. So you fooled me on that one. I thought that could be you.
He's much cuter than I am.
He is a cute little boy. And then the other photographs in your book I enjoyed, and I didn't assume they were all your family.
No.
That you had gathered these photographs. But it does really take us back to that period of time. You have a photograph of a guy in his sailor hat, and in the story, we imagine that's Uncle Wynn.
Yes. Exactly.
But it wasn't a relative of yours, I assume.
No, he wasn't. It's Buck Adair, my friend Mike Adair's dad. Mike lives up in Northern California up here. Are you listening, Mike? It's a wonderful photo because he's a big, tough young man in his sailor's uniform. It's the war maybe has just started at that point. And that's the character of Uncle Wynn. He looks just like I imagined Uncle Wynn to look like as I was writing the book. I didn't actually have an Uncle Wynn. I had lots of uncles, but not quite one who had the history of this fellow who fought his way through the Pacific and then came back to California to work in a cannery.
My guest is Fred Setterberg, and his book is Lunch Bucket Paradise, a true life novel. So when you're telling us about the narrator, mm-hmm. I'll say the narrator in the story, is telling us about his parents, were there similarities in your own parents' story, for your mother, for example?
Yeah, there were similarities. For my mom, to a degree, she was born to Italian immigrants, grew up in Boston, came out to California right after the war, really had a crushing experience when her mom died, and as the only unmarried girl in the family, saw her future clearly, which would have been taking care of her dad, and not wanting to be the spinster daughter who would never leave home, she, in a very bold fashion, came west. You know, she had that spirit of so many people who came west, and the rest of her family thought it was madness, you know, whoever.
But she was
west.
35 in the story. I don't know if your mother was actually that
old. She was a little younger than that. But still, it was a kind of kicking off the shackles that we don't really know about in California, you know, that way that much of the country, and particularly in Italian culture, you stay home. You stay in the neighborhood. You marry another Italian, or if it's a generation on, you marry someone who's Irish. And life goes on as it has gone on. So there was a quality of kind of, I think, real courage in her coming to San Francisco. And she was absolutely in love with San Francisco. And it was sort of hard to leave the city and move to the suburbs in the East Bay where she lived with my father and the rest of our family. She wanted to have a home. She wanted to start a new life. But there was something maybe a little too primitive about it still. You know, it was the country as becoming. It was, you know, we didn't quite know where we were going to end up yet. I mean, I think she was very happy because she was an optimistic and buoyant person. My father, people often ask me, are the characters in the book based on people you grew up with? And I have to say, for the most part, no. For the most part, they are inventions. But the great exception is the character of Franklin, the father in the book. And he is my dad, Spencer, born in the prairie in Canada. His parents were immigrants from Scandinavia. He had gone back to live in Norway as a child, then back to Canada. They were farmers. They lost everything when the wheat prices collapsed, came to the U.S., farmed, lost everything during the Depression. And he was a very smart, funny, angry, resentful, generous, self-educated, exasperating person. And very much, I think, the nettle that kept me writing this book, wanting to come to grips with him in some way, even if I had to reinvent him. He also contracted tuberculosis in his late 20s, like Franklin in the book, and it was one of the most important things in shaping him. He had then, for the first time in his life, the opportunity to read. You know, he didn't get beyond high school, but now he was sick. And for 4 years, he couldn't leave the public hospital in San Francisco. So he immersed himself in every book that the library had. You know, he drilled his way through the Rivers of America series. He absorbed every bit of American history that he could. He was a very well-read, widely read person in the manner of the self-educated, which is to say it's kind of a lurching pothole. You get a little interest in something, and you pursue that. You drop it, you move another direction. But I was very old until I felt like I could actually sit down and confidently argue with him about subjects because he just knew too much. You know? I had to get well beyond college before I could really hold my own with him.
You also mentioned his favorite book, the most important book, that is, when he was there in the TB ward. and he read Jack London.
That's right. This is actually a true story, though it seems quite improbable. He was in the TB ward for about 3.5 years, and finally the doctor said to him, "Sorry, you're just not going to make it. People don't get better after this point, so it's really time to say goodbye to everybody. You know, write your family and let them know. You put up a good fight, let them go." But around this time, he had picked up a copy of Jack London's not terribly well-known novel, The Star Rover. And this is about a convict, a Swedish convict, in fact, from which was his background, in San Quentin, who is in solitary confinement. And he learns to, for want of a better word, astro-travel. He sends himself through a universe of other incarnations, a Viking mercenary, a judge, a soldier. And my dad read that book and thought to himself, I can do that. Not that I can send myself spinning into other incarnations, but I can bite down hard on my brain and I can bring all the grit and resolve to healing myself because nobody else can do it, right? I mean, if there was ever a motto he had, it was, you got to do it yourself. No one does anything for you. Not exactly true in his life either. I mean, he did lots of things for lots of people, you know, starting with me. But
he could see that if he just sat there in that hospital, he was not going to get well.
That's right.
From what other people were doing.
That's right. So every day he would gather, you know, a minute or 5 or 10 minutes of concentration, as much as he had energy for, and he would imagine his lungs clearing. He would imagine him getting himself stronger each day. And 6 months later, they let him out of the hospital, and he said, "Well, we don't know what happened. You know, miracles happen. Good luck. Go out and have yourself a life now." And so that's what he did.
And you say he hardly had the energy because he got really thin.
Right. He was a slender guy at that point, and you know, tuberculosis is a wasting disease, and he was a scarecrow once he came out, but able to step into the new America, I think. In some ways, it seemed so fitting to me that someone who had come through the disease of history, right, the terrible years of the early 20th century, the world on fire, the world collapsing, and here is a guy who then buckles down and imagines a new step, and he steps right into America at the perfect moment when there's an escalator that takes working people out of the depths of a tradition of poverty and endless struggle and into a possibility of having a pretty good life. I also want to say that, you know, this book is bordered by two wars. The World War II is a memory for all of the adults in the book and a vision of fantasy and misunderstanding for most of the kids, particularly the boys. And the other war is Vietnam. And the book ends about 1970. And this is a community where a lot of the guys are going to end up in Vietnam. It's a working class town. This was the working class war, not through great enthusiasm for most people, but with a sense of inevitability and stoicism. And I think some of the first accurate reports that we got about the futility of the war, about the folly of the war in Vietnam, came from the young vets who came back home and said, "You know, folks, it's just not what you're reading about. It's something else. It's something you can't quite imagine." But it's important to me that the book also it ends just as we're beginning to anticipate the collapse, the evening out of wages. Wages collapse in terms of, you know, rising in 1974. They never recover for the blue collar America.
My guest is Fred Setterberg, and we're talking about his book, Lunch Bucket Paradise, a true life novel. And you talk in your book about where the narrator's father was on December 7th, 1941. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, is that story one that you picked up from somewhere else, or was that from your own family?
No, I was just imagining him, Franklin, or my dad, in fact, on the Bay Bridge. You know, seems like the perfect place to be, you know, looking east and living in the West and experiencing anticipating what's about to happen.
Well, why don't you read us a couple of paragraphs that the narrator is saying that his dad heard the news about Pearl Harbor. This is on page 70.
Okay. Dad heard the news about Pearl Harbor while driving over the Bay Bridge, hurrying home for weekend overtime at the Alameda Naval Air Station to a studio apartment in the Mission District. He had been back in the world for 4 months, fully employed for almost three. He couldn't believe the Japanese would attack Pearl Harbor. Win, his brother Win, was stationed at Pearl Harbor. He had told Clara that he'd loved Hawaii. The Japanese must be crazy, thought Dad, foolish beyond belief. They couldn't hope to win the war. Everything my father had read in the TB ward about the Far East, the history of naval conflict, the physics and chemistry of munitions manufacture, and the economics of industrial capacity told him so. My father's car approached the magnificent arc of the Bay Bridge, traffic running in either direction on the top span in those days. Some cars pulled over after hearing the news on their own radios, the drivers compelled to alert their fellow citizens. They flagged down other motorists, screaming nonsense into the deafening wind. Dad's blue Hudson reached the cantilever's peak, the bridge swaying above the water, the city revealed. He drove slowly enough to inspect the ferry building and the ships docked at the port, and he imagined them shrouded in flame with Jap Zeros flush in the sky. He thought about Pearl, his brother, the inconceivable stupidity of it all, and he wondered whatever happened to that hammer, a hammer that his brother had borrowed from him.
The only time his brother came to visit him in the TV board was
to borrow his tools.
Yeah.
Tools actually play a big role in this book, and it's I think I'm realistically depicting how important they were to men of that era and how there was a ritual of handing your tools down to your sons. My dad was a sheet metal worker, and of course most of the tools he used at work, wouldn't be there at home, but he had then the array of car repair tools and tools to build things on the house and to repair the house. Always the conviction that if there's something wrong, of course you need to do it yourself. The idea of paying a carpenter, a plumber, or an electrician to come in and do something is, that our people didn't do that, is what I would hear again and again. And unfortunately, I never learned to use the tools well at all. I was, I had 10 thumbs. And
A pen and paper were what your stock and trade, your
tools.
Well,
I think I actually have approached writing very much in that manner. I have a sense that there's a lot of craft and small detail work that comes in every piece of serious writing. And when your first few drafts are that only, they're what you do on the way to actually reaching the finished thing. And you know when it's finished. You know what a good job is, and you know what a shoddy job is.
My guest is Fred Setterberg, and his book is Lunch Bucket Paradise, a true life novel. And because so much of your book does ring true, I figured this must be true, too. In the story, the narrator's father has had all his teeth pulled by the Army.
Yeah, that was true, in fact. So perverse. Dental hygiene wasn't what it is today in the 1930s. And when my dad joined the Army, before World War II, they offered this terrific cost-saving measure of yanking his teeth and giving him a set of false teeth, which for the rest of his life he enjoyed taking out at dinner and making snap like Charlie McCarthy, the dummy, as everybody else groaned and screamed at him to put those teeth back in his mouth where they belonged.
Well, there were other touches that made it so real for those. Even though I grew up 3,000 miles on the other side of the United States, there were so many things that brought back memories for me. The little details, like in what you read about the Hudson, the Blue Hudson, because I remember when the cars had a distinctive look,
right,
each manufacturer. And you also mentioned Jap Zeros. And I noticed, too, that you don't rewrite history. When the young boys are talking, they use words that we would be offended by today.
Oh, yes. They're crude young boys, and it only grows worse as they become teenagers. But everybody who's had a teenage boy knows that this is the way they are. They're uncivilized beasts, and they need to be slowly civilized so you can let them out and loose into society. But I'm trying to really write about kids as they are. And for my wife had read many, many drafts of this book. And in the early chapters, I show some of the boys playing war, as we did always, and the kind of casual, intense cruelty that was part of that. And her response was, oh, my God, were boys really like that? You know, she had two sisters. And yes, indeed, they were. My sense is actually is that today boys are a little more civilized than we were. And perhaps the nightmare of World War II, I mean, today it's sacrosanct. It's talked about as, you know, as the – it's our great patriotic war. You know, that's what the Russians call it. But in the sense we have the same attitude towards it. And I think it really verges on sentimentality where we fail to acknowledge that this was one of the most devastating traumas of history. And for those very young men and some very young women who found themselves in Europe and the Pacific for up to 4 years, it was a shattering experience that many brought back great nightmares that they never really could reveal to their families, but they lived with in a way that I think was extremely painful. And those nightmares, I think in places like Jefferson Manor, the community I've modeled after Washington Manor, where I grew up, great leap of imagination here, I've moved to Jefferson. I think that those nightmares were right underneath the grass sod and the concrete, and that potential for violence would erupt again and again. I remember the men of my father's generation, of our neighborhood, many of them being very formidable and terrifying figures, silent, brooding, apt to flare into anger and violence, unpredictable, and big. You know, and not until you grew to be a teenager could you begin to challenge their supremacy and maybe come to understand them a little bit. Understand what it was that they brought to your house, and you know what rough materials those were.
Well, the narrator and his friends are impressed by things like the young man who was in Germany at the same time that Elvis Presley was, and he said, "Oh yeah, did you see that movie G.I. Blues? Well, that's me standing there by Elvis. We hung out together."
Right, that's right. Of course, he was in a different city than Elvis was, as any close reader of Elvis Arcana will know in that chapter. But yeah, This is, I think, another piece of mid-American, mid-20th century American life that is a little lost to us today. The young men who would come home from the service before Vietnam, during Vietnam, and would end up sleeping in an aunt and uncle's garage for 2 years until he figured out what he was going to do. I was saying to someone yesterday that during Vietnam, I knew lots of guys who were in Vietnam. I was not. Had a cousin who was a Marine. And that was part of the culture, and it's telling to me, and not a good thing, I think, that I really don't know, in this case would be the parents of anybody who just has returned from Iraq or Afghanistan. You know, the truth of those worlds isn't as readily available to us in the same way that previous wars were, and I think it allows us to turn our eyes away from what we're doing, and to not really reckon in an honest and full-hearted way with where we are in the world right now.
My guest is Fred Setterberg, and he has written a true life novel, Lunch Bucket Paradise, and the true life part of it are characters that some were based on, like you mentioned, your father. Some were invented characters. But again, you have all these details that you throw in of the times. You have Junior Walker in the All-Stars that played Cleo's back.
Yes.
And I had that record, and I played it until the vinyl wore out. Now, the comic books, you mentioned Archie and Veronica, Casper the Friendly Ghost. I think we all have heard of those comic books. So there were certain things that were gender-specific, I think, right, as far as what the boys remembered. But I noticed you knew that girls ratted their hair, so I thought maybe your wife clued you in on that.
My wife actually her sister just made a fantastic album for her birthday of her hairdos through the years. So starting as a baby and moving up to the present. But no, she actually wasn't part of the ratted hair brigade. But it was part of the style of the school that I went to. You know,
you also mentioned the Regency transistor radio, and I don't think people realize that there was the day when we couldn't carry around a radio on our person.
Right.
That these were sets in the home.
I give the book a musical background, And it becomes more important as my unnamed narrator grows into adolescence. So in fact, he ends up playing in a band, in a soul band, the Lost Souls. They're all white and Latino kids playing black music, playing the Motown and Stax and Volt. They play 27 James Brown songs. I was playing with what was the truth in the community I grew up in, which was that people loved black music, and the town kept an absolute border lined up at the Oakland border, in which black people were not allowed to buy homes in that community. And there was a kind of terror, a kind of really, I've thought of it as a kind of almost psychotic racism that pervaded the town at that time. Even while people held James Brown and Aretha Franklin in, you know, the highest possible esteem. You know, it's one of those great contradictions of America, I think, you know, that at the moment when the civil rights movement is reached its peak, when we're moving into the Black Power movement, when the cities are burning, Motown, Berry Gordy in Detroit is creating what will become the background music for every middle-class burger's barbecue for the rest of the century and into the 21st century. You know, those great recordings by Smokey Robinson and the Supremes and, you know, so much else.
You also mentioned, referred to the fact that we were so afraid of the Russians at this time in the 50s that some people were building bomb shelters and some people were not building bomb shelters. And so you have both of those viewpoints come up in your book, Through the Young Boys.
Yeah, I have my narrator, his best friend, Phil Barnes, his best friend's dad is building a bomb shelter because he's a paranoid John Bircher, basically. You know, he has a skewed vision of the world that we can still recognize today. And I mean, it's strange that, you know, this is sort of the mythology of childhood in the 50s, that we're looking always at the possibility of Armageddon and trying to finesse Armageddon. You know, what shall we bring Kool-Aid into the bomb shelter? You know, what will we do when we return?
And then you have your narrator's father says, oh, no, we're not building any bomb shelter.
Right. Yeah, well, he thinks it's you know, the foolishness that it is.
So your book covers all these things that we remember. For example, if you have a lawn, you're going to fill that lawn full of pesticides. And you have your narrator asking his dad, well, will this hurt you? And his dad said, are you a snail? He said, well, in that case, no, you don't have to worry about that. So there are all these things that come up that we can, those of a certain generation, can relate to. And I think those who say it was their grandparents' generation instead of their parents' generation can get some insights into what life was like then.
Yeah, I really do think it's a different world. And we lose a lot if we just think it's an ideal world. If you know, the book is called Lunch Bucket Paradise. And what's in paradise? Well, a snake is in paradise. You know, there is no paradise. There's always a serpent who's there threatening at any time to subvert it. And I wanted to subvert some of the notions about the ideal years of the 50s and 60s.
It's been such a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much, Nancy.
My guest has been Fred Setterberg. His book is Lunch Bucket Paradise. After a break, we'll hear stories from a small airport diner told by Chico author and retired dentist Mike Paul in his book, Tales from the Sky Kitchen Cafe. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Mike Paul was president of the San Mateo County Dental Society and examiner on the State Dental Licensing Board. He's retired now and lives in Chico, but is still its consultant to the Dental Board of California. In 1979, Dr. Paul earned a private pilot license, followed by an instrument rating, commercial license, multi-engine rating, and a flight instructor license. He has accumulated 3,500 hours of flying time and was the founding president of the San Carlos Airport Pilots Association in San Mateo County. He collected stories from a small airport diner where local pilots congregate to exchange friendship and conversation. These stories are now published in a book, Tales from the Sky Kitchen Cafe. Mike Paul, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You know, your book is a book of stories, but the book itself has a story. And I thought it was very interesting that in the 1950s, there was a little 14-year-old boy in Iran that played a role in this book coming to be. I mean, you might not be sitting here right now if this young man hadn't had a dream.
That's true. That's very true. The person you're speaking about is the owner of this little cafe called the Sky Kitchen Cafe, and he had dreams of coming to America, which he eventually did. And he found his way to the Sky Kitchen Cafe, where he became the owner and eventually became a very, very successful businessman and restaurant owner in the San Francisco Peninsula area. But he always held on to this little cafe that was his benchmark, head of the fleet.
In fact, he turned it around. Other people had tried to make a go of this little diner, and the previous owners had not been able to. But he was such a hard worker that he was able to be successful.
That's true. When he was when the cafe was first opened, it was called Andy's Coffee Shop, and this terminal building had just been built. The developer was getting very nervous about the coffee shop because it didn't do very well, and it eventually went bankrupt, and it passed through several owners. Until this 26-year-old Iranian immigrant came to the United States and made a success of it.
You know what? In fact, a lot of times when I'm reading a book, I see this book could be a movie. But when I was reading your book, I thought this book could be a lots of movies. Every chapter in it, could be turned into a movie because the central character in each of these stories has done amazing things with their lives. And Ben was one of them. The owner of the Sky Kitchen Cafe.
Yeah, very interesting. And that happens to be the last chapter in the book. All of the other chapters are really about pilots and their adventures and their accomplishments. But this is about the accomplishment of somebody who wasn't a pilot. And one of his dreams was to come to the United States. And when he was young in Iran, he used to watch American movies. And some of them would always backdrop California. Well, most of them would, the teenage movies. And his idea of California or of America was California. And in California, the American dream was driving a convertible and going across the Golden Gate Bridge with your hair waving in the wind. The last time I saw Ben, and he's still healthy and well, but the last time I saw him, he asked if I wanted to take a ride, which I did, and we got into his brand new silver Mercedes convertible, and I'm sure I knew we were heading towards the Golden Gate Bridge.
Well, I happen to remember that movie that inspired him when Dustin Hoffman's riding across the Bay Bridge in his convertible, and I thought, oh, I wonder if Ben ever actually rode the very bridge that he imagined, because it wasn't the Golden Gate, it was the Bay Bridge.
I'm sure he didn't know at that time.
But that is a wonderful story. Like I said, that could be a movie right there in itself. But the date that stands out, I'm sure, in your memory, because you tell about this, was August 25th of 1978. And what happened on that day?
Well, I was practicing dentistry down in San Carlos, California, just south of San Francisco. I'd been there about 15 years. And I'd seen a lot of patients. I started very young as a dentist. So even though a patient was in his 20s, I may have seen him for the last 15 years. And this young man came in, and I knew he was pretty successful. He was an engineer. He was, with National Semiconductor, which was one of the Silicon Valley firms. And he flopped down in the chair, and he says, "Hey, Doc, how would you like a flying lesson?" And I said, a flying lesson? You're an engineer. He says, yeah, but I don't want to be an engineer. I want to be an airline pilot. And in order to be an airline pilot, you have to go through this this ladder. You have to build hours. And in order to build hours and experience, you have to teach other people to fly. So he figured I was a natural candidate, and certainly I was. He said, come on, we'll go out. It'll be a free lesson, and I'll give you a logbook, et cetera, et cetera. Well, that lesson was free, but the ones that followed weren't. I did get the license, obviously, about 6 months later.
So he recognized talent when he saw it.
I don't know if he recognized talent or whether he saw that I could pay the bill. But in either case, I got the license.
My guest is Mike Paul, and he is a retired dentist who's written the book Tales from the Sky Kitchen Cafe about all the stories that he heard sitting around the counter and a little diner in the Bay Area. Now, when you get so enthused about flying, it seems logical that you would get your best friend interested in flying. So the two of you, you say, well, you know, it'd be a good idea if you want to take flying lessons, why don't we just go in and buy a plane together?
I did say that, and I almost regretted it. my friend, his name was Len, and we did buy an airplane together, and he ended up taking lessons in that airplane, but there was an unfortunate event that took place.
Well, you didn't realize that it was. You were just sitting innocently in your office one afternoon, right? And that's what happened? Why don't you read that from your book?
Well, let me just preface it. In order to get a pilot license, you have to go on what they call solo cross countries, which mean you fly the airplane alone for a certain distance. So the day that my friend Len went on his first solo cross-country flight, and I'll read here from the book, I was working in my office, and around 3 o'clock I glanced out the window. The tree branches were swaying, and the wind was kicking up. I felt a little twinge in the pit of my stomach, but went back to work. Around 4 o'clock I received a phone call that turned the twinge into a knot. This is the control tower at San Carlos Airport. Are you the owner of a Cessna 172 number N80362? I'm one of the owners, I answered. Can you get down here? There's been an accident, the controller replied. I froze. I stammered. Is anyone hurt? I can't give you that information on the phone. Can you get down here? I jumped into my car and I raced toward the airport. As I approached, an ambulance was speeding in the opposite direction. I pulled into the airport and could see several emergency lights near the dike, which holds the bay water from flooding the airport. When I reached the lights, my heart almost stopped. There in the water, with only its tail sticking out, sat the 172. I quickly extracted enough information to determine that Len was not seriously hurt, but was taken to the hospital for observation. I made the call to his wife and met her at the hospital. I had a weight lifted from my shoulders when the doctor confirmed that Len was fine.
My guest is Mike Paul. He's reading from one of the Tales from the Sky Kitchen Cafe. And this was when he first got started as a pilot, and his friend and he went in to get a plane together. But that story has a happy ending. Not only was Len fine, but he went on to have a very good record
as a
pilot.
Yeah, Len,
that wasn't the first of many disasters. That was
that was the last of any disaster. And he flew. He still flies now and then. He's retired in Arizona. But he amassed about 2,000 hours and never had an incident, never had a problem. And he was one of the safest pilots I ever flew with.
Well, you have a lot of stories in here about people who do rather amazing things and not always limited to here in the United States. And one of the pilots whose story you gathered flew various places in the world. And one of the places he flew, he was advised to have an axe on board. And when you're reading this story, you think, an axe? Why are they telling him he needs an axe?
Well, that was very interesting. As a matter of fact, when he told me this story, I got quite a kick out of it. He was flying in the Mideast, and he was flying from Damascus to Kuwait. And navigation there is a little difficult. And he was just a private pilot. As a matter of fact, that's the name of the story, just a private pilot. And he wanted to get some information on how to fly from Damascus to Kuwait without going over the border of Iraq. So I wrote in here. May I read it to you?
Yes, please do.
In order to fly the shortest route from Damascus to Kuwait, it was necessary to fly along the border of Iraq. Reed needed advice regarding what navigation to use in order to avoid Iraqi airspace. He found a fellow who appeared to have the information he needed. The fellow said, "Do you have an axe on board?" Astonished, Reed said, "I'm flying across the desert. Why would I need an axe?" "Well, there's a navigation beacon, but it hasn't worked for 6 months. The most reliable navigation is to follow the Trans-Arabian pipeline that runs just south of the Iraqi border all the way to Kuwait." Reed nodded his head and asked, "How about the axe? What do we need the axe for?" The man suddenly realized he had left out the most important piece of information. "Oh, yes, there's a service road that runs right next to the pipeline. If you get into trouble, you can land on the road. Take your axe and chop a hole in the pipeline. When you get a big enough puddle of oil on the ground, somebody will come out and see what's wrong, and they'll help you. Otherwise, you might be stuck in the desert forever." Luckily, the axe stayed in the sheath all the way to Kuwait.
My guest is Mike Paul. He's reading one of the stories from his book, Tales from the Sky Kitchen Cafe. And that wasn't the last of his adventures. I mean, that would be adventure enough for anybody, I would think. But then he had a rather unusual opportunity to come his way after this. And what was that adventure about?
Well, there was a female pilot who decided to reenact the Amelia Earhart Around the World flight. Of course, Amelia's flight ended in disaster, as we all know. But 35 years later, I'm trying to remember the exact amount. At any rate, on the anniversary of the flight, this other female pilot flew around the world 26,400 nautical miles, and Reed, our hero in this story, flew alongside her because he had a large plane that could land on water. And he did the exact same flight and started in Oakland, ended up in Oakland just like Amelia had, I think it was 50 years before.
And could carry the photographers and people to record her trip.
That's true. He had the photographers, the videographers. He had the newspaper people and his wife who went on almost every trip with him.
So this story had a happy ending, too, as far as endings go. I mean, that was a very successful trip for him.
Very.
And there were some stories that that might seem not to have a happy ending, so to speak. There was one where you described the crash of a 91-year-old. And I thought, you know, that's sad for the family. You always feel sad when someone dies. But I think, boy, 91 years old and flying an airplane, I mean, that to me is just, I couldn't be sad about that story. I thought, that's great. Good. All power to that guy, 91, and he goes out in a blaze of glory.
The only sad part of the story is there were other occupants in the airplane. The fellow's name was Bob, and Bob was well known at the Sky Kitchen Cafe. He was a World War II pilot. He flew B-29s also, but that was in Europe. And Bob... all the pilots suspected that Bob would spend his last day in an airplane, and that's exactly what he did. And from that aspect, for Bob, it wasn't a sad ending. The only sad ending was there were other people with him.
Yeah. Well, since you bring up World War II, one of the most amazing stories in your book is set in, well, it happened that these two guys met at the Sky Kitchen Cafe, but their paths had crossed somewhat, so to speak, many years before, 50 years before, one of these guys was actually bombing, not personally bombing, the other guy. But one guy was on the ground, and the American was flying over, they're both Americans, dropping bombs on this prison camp in Japan. This is just such an amazing story. Were you there the day that this one guy walks in and sits down beside his fellow flyer? Well, one was a navigator and one was a pilot.
Yeah, they were both aviators.
Did you happen to be there that day?
I did. The story is called The Pilot and the POW, and the pilot was the commander of a B-29. He was my friend Phil. He and I had owned an airplane together, so we knew each other quite well. And Phil had led what was called a firestorm, where most people don't know this. I certainly didn't know it, but a firestorm is created when you take a certain set of conditions and a certain set of material that'll burn very rapidly, which is exactly what Tokyo looked like in 1945. And Phil let in 339 bombers, and they created a firestorm in Tokyo that burned up the equivalent of almost half of San Francisco. It was the largest fire ever set by man. And what most of us don't know is that 100,000 civilians were killed in Tokyo on March 10th, 1945. And Phil, unfortunately, was the one that led that. That was more people that were killed in the atom bomb, either on Nagasaki or Hiroshima. But it wasn't quite as spectacular for the newspapers. But he did lead that. And 50 years later, in 1995, when we walked into the little Sky Kitchen Cafe, sitting next to us was a navigator who had bailed out over Tokyo 2 months earlier, before the firestorm. And he was sitting terrified in a prison camp while his comrades were bombing Japan.
And you were there when Phil walks in and sits down, and these two guys get to meet each other. And you know what I found really inspiring? These two went back to Japan from time to time, and Phil in particular went back 9 times. So he made a lot of friends in Japan, but two of them were really special friends. And would you read this section in your book where
I will.
Phil gets to meet two people that he had known during World War II?
Okay, well, this is Hap. Hap was the navigator. He was the one that was the prisoner of war. Phil was the pilot. And just to preface this little part, I think you should know when Hap bailed out of the B-29, he was in a parachute at about 8,000 feet, and three Japanese fighters came up on him. Two of them left, which made Hap think that the last one was there to shoot holes in his parachute so that he would smash to the ground and obviously get killed. But the flyer of the Japanese fighter plane didn't do that. He saluted Hap, and he turned the plane 180 degrees, and he flew off. So Hap returned 9 times to Japan. He became a well-known personality and was asked to speak at dozens of meetings and events. He eventually realized he had more friends in Japan than he had in the United States. He often visited them, and often they came to California to visit him. Of the hundreds of friends he made in Japan, two were special to him. As the war was coming to an end, and as Hap fought for survival in Omari Prison, he was befriended by a prison guard. Kobayashi was a schoolmaster before the war and wasn't suited for the job he was assigned. A gentle and inquisitive person, he was the guard who had slipped Hap the chocolate. Hap reunited with Kobayashi and returned his kindness by helping him come to the United States for schooling. Over the subsequent years, they were guests in each other's homes and became good friends. Another and most important contact he was able to make.
So this was, to interrupt you just for a second, you tell earlier in the story that when he was in this prison that there were some guards who were compassionate, and one gave him some chocolate, and he never forgot that. And then years later, he gets to meet this guy who had been so kind to him in the prison and given him that piece of chocolate.
Exactly, because they were treated so cruelly.
Described some of what it's just hard to
imagine. In one prison, Hap was given one ball of rice a day, which they would roll in through a little slot, and it was full of maggots and weevils. It was almost impossible to eat. So you can imagine when a guard slipped him a piece of chocolate, what a treat that was.
And he never forgot that.
Never.
And then he never forgot that pilot who spared his life, who could have killed him.
Yeah, this man was probably the most important person in his life. And the war actually molded Hap's future life. But he talked about meeting this fighter pilot again. Another and most important contact he was able to make was with a man named Hideki. Hideki was the fighter pilot who approached Hap when he was swinging in his chute, the pilot who chose to salute rather than shoot. He remembered that day as vividly as Hap. Hap asked him, "Why did you allow me to live instead of shooting me?" He answered, "Some of us flyers had integrity and dignity. Some of us had honor, and we respected our fellow flyers." On one of his last visits to Japan, Hideki's son contacted Hap, informed him that his father had died, and requested that Hap attend the funeral. The feelings of gratitude welled up in Hap as he looked for the last time at the man who spared his life. Hap brought his hand to his forehead, saluted the honorable flyer, and bowed his head as he left the sanctuary.
My guest is Mike Paul. He's a retired dentist who is a pilot, still is a pilot, and he collected stories heard around the counter at the Sky Kitchen Cafe in the airport in San Carlos. This story is just such an amazing story on so many levels. First of all, that Hap and Phil were to meet after all these years, after 50 years. And then for, it just gives me chills to think about this, that Hap got to go to the funeral of the man who had saved his life, who could have killed him, and this Japanese pilot who saluted him. And Hap got to return the favor and salute him when he died.
He did. And the sub-story in this story is the fact that these facts all came out at the counter of a little cafe in an airport in San Carlos, California, 50 years later, I might add.
Yeah, this really is an amazing place that, because amazing people gather here with their stories. And there was one guy who'd been coming the whole time, and you refer to him as the mayor. And you said that you and the mayor had some expressions that about pilots and about flying. For example, one it was, "Never fly with anybody named Ace or Buzz." I think you could count on them taking unnecessary chances, probably. Another one, cautioning pilots not to come in too fast when they're coming in for a landing. "Even if you have a long runway, it won't help if most of it's behind the airplane." And then you say about pilots who flew into weather that was a little dicey, "I'd rather be down here wishing I was up there than being up there wishing I was down here." So most of you, though, really enjoyed flying, and to the point that you wouldn't accept a boring life. And I think in particular one who was a test pilot, and he could have had I won't call it a boring life, he could have had a different life, but he chose to have an interesting life, even though he broke his back twice. That was just amazing that he breaks his back and he still gets right back on the horse, gets right back in the plane, and wants to fly again. There was one other expression that you and saying that you and Herb recorded. "There are old pilots and there are bold pilots, but there are no old bold pilots."
That's that's a very common expression in flying, and sometimes it's true and sometimes it's not. But it's a good expression to live by if you're a pilot.
Yeah, to be cautious.
Absolutely.
But now this guy who he set a lot of records, the one who was the test pilot, and he started out. He got into racing, and he didn't think he would. I think somebody suggested, "Why don't you try air racing?" And he, okay. So he kind of reluctantly tried it the first time, and once he tried it, he loved it. Now, this is something that I didn't even know that there was such a thing as air racing, and I imagine it like an Indy 500 in the sky, that these planes circling, racing.
Well, it is. It's similar to that. And they race around what's called pylons, which are large, you can call them sticks, but they're 50 feet high. And those are the they mark the racetrack. This fellow is very, very interesting and very well known at the Sky Kitchen. They used to call him Crazy Dave because he seemed to do a lot of things that some of us thought were crazy. And there was one thing, I mentioned it in the book, is when he broke his back, I think it was the second time, he knew he was going to be hurt. The airplane was totally out of control, but he had about 2 minutes before he hit the ground. So he took a clipboard and wrote on it and strapped it to his knee, and it said, "Unless I'm burning, don't try to move me."
Yes.
So that was the kind of guy that that Dave. Well, he still is. I don't want to say was in the past. Yeah. Dave is still doing what I described him as doing, and that's test flying and racing airplanes.
Yeah, so he breaks his back. It gets in, flies again, and that was, I couldn't help but laugh at that. Here he is. You can see the plane, if you're watching this as a movie. Here's this plane hurtling toward the earth, and he whips out his pad and writes a note to the paramedic saying, "Don't move me unless I'm on fire."
Exactly.
My guest is Mike Paul, and he's reading from his Tales from the Sky Kitchen Cafe, where he collected stories of pilots who would gather around this table. And you say sometimes people would kind of accidentally sit down there. Maybe they weren't a pilot, but the conversation was so fascinating that they would want to hang around and hear what the stories were.
Well, the pilots kind of became the entertainment for the other people who came into the cafe. And, you know, I speak of the Sky Kitchen Cafe here as past tense. It still exists. I fly down there, or at least I try to, at least once a month or every 2 months. A lot of the people I talk about in the book are still members of that little fraternity, and people come to it every single day, the non-pilots, to eat there and to listen to the chatter at the center counter.
Well, you tell a story, too, that I think a lot of us apply to our lives anyway, and you ask one of these pilots, you know, you've gotten so close to winning these competitions, but you've only gotten close. You've gotten, if they accepted five and you got to position eight, aren't you sorry you didn't make it all the way to win? And what did he say?
Well, the story we're speaking about is Norm, who was an aerobatic pilot, and they have a national aerobatic contest, and he didn't make it, but I asked him, you know, if he was unhappy.
And he said that it really didn't matter, that he just got close, that what?
That the journey was more important than the destination.
It's been such a thrill listening to these stories, reading these stories, and hearing about all these pilots that gather around this table. Thank you so much, Mike Paul.
You're welcome.
His book is Tales from the Sky Kitchen Cafe. I'd also like to thank my first guest, Fred Setterberg, author of Lunch Bucket Paradise. The fifth grade at Chico Country Day School is going to be having a book signing. It'll take place on December 16th, and the authors will be at the Made in Chico store from 10 to 4 p.m. to talk about and sign their book, Strolling Through Chico, A Fifth Grade Perspective. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.